It's Friday, October 22nd, 2004, 10:04 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we're going to give you the latest in geek news. In about 15 minutes, we're going to talk with math expert Ralph Abraham. And of course, we're taking your pledges all show long. The numbers are 476-5900 or 1-800-655-5877. If you'd like to ask us a tech question, which we'll be taking throughout the show, you're welcome to visit geekspeak.org to send us email. But your first visit, of course, kusp.org. Click on the big blue button and donate. Pledge your support for KUSP. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Geek John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com, and also a Macintosh expert, aficionado, and a lover of space. And John and I are going to do a bit of geek news. John, Ralph Abraham is in here in the audience, and or in the mic, in the air room with us. And Ralph, if you'd like to add to the news, you're welcome to do so.
Thank you.
John.
Morning.
Your first story.
First, I have some non-space news.
Okay.
This is in honor of Sean, who is not here. Sean has undergone major trauma. He's okay. dental surgery.
Teeth pulling,
oh,
yes.
God. Anyway, Microsoft released Service Pack 2 not too long ago, and there's already been 106 million downloads of Service Pack 2.
So, and they're giving away free CDs.
Yeah. So that kind of shows the market penetration of XP in the wilderness, so to speak. So it's a very heavily used operating system. We knew that. But still, having 106 million downloads at this time is interesting because that, at least that many people are using XP. And it's good to know that that many people are updating XP. So people are aware of security concerns and they're taking proactive steps.
Which you basically, you have to be aware of that if you're a Windows user.
Yes, you do.
If you're not, you're in trouble.
Right.
And if you haven't done Service Pack 2, either download it or go ahead and go to Microsoft.com and you can find somewhere on there a form to have it sent to you via CD, which is probably faster.
And it's free CD. It's a free download.
Right.
But it's better to have the CD, especially if you have a slower connection, because it does once you download the install and then start running the installer, you still need a network connection because
right.
it's going up.
Right.
The CD's free and shipping for the CD's free.
A little safer, too. All right. John?
You don't
it's
have
fun
to.
Going right back to you, huh?
Yeah, normally we have more geeks doing this.
Let me talk about the next week's show. We're going to be talking about electronic voting next week and how the systems for electronic voting works, the penetration across the U.S., what success stories we have from, like, Australia on electronic voting. I know you're pretty much a proponent of paper and pencil. Or pen.
I am, but there is an act that was passed that requires us by 2006 to have electronic voting available. And, okay, I started out as totally against electronic voting. We'll go more into this next week.
Yes.
But my position has changed.
Okay.
So next after doing some research, we've got some information.
Next week's Geek Speak, electronic voting. Okay, go on.
Speaking of electronics, that was a horrible segue. We have a new product out. I have an iPod. And I love
little music playing device.
Right. I love to listen to it in the car, but I have to use the tape insert because using the FM transmitters that I've found just hasn't worked. There's a company called iPod Car that's come out with a new product that actually plugs into your radio via a little box. It's got a little black box. So it comes out with a little dongle that you plug your third or fourth generation iPod into, and then that hooks directly into the back of the stereo.
And so you have to have this installed.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, you can do it yourself, but yeah. They have instructions and websites to help you install it.
How to crack open your dashboard.
Right, and to make sure that your radio is compatible.
Right.
The cool thing is, like, if you have a new Prius and it has the on steering wheel controls, you can use those controls for your iPod.
Ooh-hoo.
Or if you have a display, depending on the complexity of the display, it will display the information, the meta information for the MP3.
Great, so you can read that while you're driving.
Right. Uh-huh. Well, Okay, let's not get
into it. So, are you going to get one of these?
No. I have a first-generation iPod.
Oh, okay.
But if you want any information about it, it's at iPodDakar.com. The only reason I say it is because every time I come across a product that's really cool, I like to let people know about it. Yeah. And iPods there's a lot of iPods out there, and listening to them in your car is great. But having all those wires isn't great.
Great. Right. Well, thank you for that story.
In space. Let's get to space
because you love space so much.
I don't know why.
You know, I think it's fascinating that this whole industry of space travel or space for not exploration, but for tourism is happening. There's a potential for a $200,000 10-minute trip to suborbital space.
Right.
If I had that kind of money, no thank you.
Why?
Well, because it's like 10 minutes and it's, you know, sure, it's a life-changing experience or something, but $200,000 can go a long way for a lot of things.
Well, then save your money.
Okay.
For about 5 years. The fellow, I don't have his information in front of me.
Fine.
The fellow who owns Virgin Airlines is planning to put space, Bigelow, I think is his name.
Yeah.
He's planning to put hotels up in space. And these are large inflatable modules that would be brought up by conventional rocket. And then the second generation of the X Prize, which is a $50 million prize to make a spaceship that can carry 7 passengers and go to an even higher altitude, which basically is an established orbit,
mm-hmm.
Will be able to ferry passengers up to these hotels. So he's helping to put up this $50 million in prize money so that people...
That would be a good...
So he's cool really trying to jumpstart the space tourism industry. So they're estimating $200,000, you can go up, spend the weekend in space.
Okay, that's different. Right. That's still way too much money to do that, but that's really different.
Right. let's see. Let's go to an event that's coming up next week, next Tuesday. The probe Cassini is currently flying around Titan. I'm sorry, it's currently flying around Saturn, and at 6:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on October 26, it'll be doing its flyby of Titan.
We covered this whole... We had a whole Titan and Cassini probe discussion about 3 months ago or so. Had an expert on about mapping the planet, and they're gonna have this thing, this probe that drops from Cassini, I think, right?
Right.
Is actually gonna penetrate the atmosphere.
Right.
And when's that happening?
The 26th of October.
Wow. Oh, that starts orbiting.
This is a flyby.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first really significant flyby.
We're going to get cool pictures.
Yeah. This is probably where they're going to map out the how and when they're going to drop the
where
probe.
Where they're going to land.
Right. They're not going to drop the
now,
probe
of course, Titan, it's not that interesting to look at from a distance because it's got a pretty dense cloud cover and you can't really see the planet.
Right.
Or the moon.
Right.
The satellite.
It's a large satellite. It's a large moon. And it's one of the last unexplored frontiers in our solar system, which
cool.
kind of says something about how well we're exploring the solar system. So, anyway, if you want to watch it, they're going to have a live webcast. And you can go to saturn.jpl.nasa.gov, and they have information for you up there. saturn.jpl.nasa.gov. And you can watch it live as it happens. Well, not really.
There's, delayed by there's 9 minutes delay. Or something.
I think it's...
Darn light thing.
I think it's about 30-some-odd minutes.
Really? Okay.
Because you're out near Saturn.
Well, thank you for that story.
No problem.
You got one more for us? Because we're going to do one more, and then we're going to get in discussion about that.
I do. There's two experiments going on. These are long-term experiments going on in space. First one's been going on for 11 years, and they've just concluded it. Not concluded it, but they've just been able to get enough data to make some conclusions. And it's been looking for what's called frame dragging. Frame dragging, Einstein has the theory of space-time and how a dense object, a massive object like the Earth, affects space-time. Basically, if you think about you have a sheet that's pulled tight,
mm-hmm.
and then you put a bowling ball in the middle, the bowling ball is going to make a big indentation in that sheet.
Sure.
So it's warping space-time. Our planet is also spinning fairly fast, 100,000 miles an hour. So what's happening is it's warping space-time, not just pulling it down, but it's also kind of like if you took a spoon and put it in some honey and started turning it, you get this kind of a whirlpool almost. So it's kind of doing that to the space-time.
This is pretty theoretical. I mean...
It was theoretical until they proved it. So they've now got proof.
Or really strong evidence of.
Well, that's true. Really strong evidence of. That every year, they put two satellites in orbit. They're about a meter in size. And they're passive satellites. They're just full of reflectors. From the ground, they're shooting lasers up to it. And then there's a third satellite that's receiving, you know, they're bouncing the light off of the reflective satellite to this other satellite. So it's basically measuring distance and time.
So you kind of have a triangulation effect between the satellites, you can determine if they have differences because
exactly.
of the shift. And do they?
Yes. Every year, the satellites are being dragged by this frame dropping effect, frame dragging effect, by 6 feet. So it's very minor, but it's 99% of what they predicted it would be.
Wow.
And there's a 10% error of margin.
Right.
So this is...
So we're warping space in a circular fashion, if you
will. Yes. Yeah. So they've been able to find definite evidence of frame dragging.
Cool.
Yeah. There's a second probe that's currently up called Gravity Probe B, which sounds like kind of a B-movie name or something, that works a little differently. What it's doing is it looks at a distant star as a focal point, a reference point, and then it's got a series of gyros inside of it. And what it's doing is it's measuring the effect that the Earth's gravity is having on these gyros. We've mapped the Earth's gravity, so what they do is they cancel out the Earth's gravity, because, you know, the Earth's gravity is different in different parts of the planet. So they map out those differences. They cancel those out. What's left is frame dragging. So this is a much longer duration experiment that's going on, but it should be a lot more accurate than the other one. So the first one had a 10% error of margin. This one should be a lot closer.
I got one closing story before we get into Ralph's discussion with Ralph Abraham about math. And this is a fake story. So there's a new technology. Well, not really new technology. Been around for a long time. A technology that I know a lot about and like a lot. And basically, it's a way of communicating one direction, and it's location-based. And the basic idea is you go up to the top of a mountain, and you set up a frequency modulation on a carrier wave and broadcast that out. And it can go for miles. And the general idea is that you'd send, like, audio on this, and you'd be able to broadcast out music and talk and all this stuff to a local area. And it's pretty cool because you don't have to have at the receiving places.
You have to have some pretty fancy equipment to pick this up.
You don't. They're like the equipment that you can pick up with this stuff is just so common. Like they're in almost every car pretty much in the U.S. except for really specialty cars don't have this technology. So basically everyone has this technology in their vehicles. Almost everyone has it in their homes, and even portable devices can pick up this signal. And it can play music, anything that's really broadcast on it. And the cool thing is that since it's location-based, it's kind of like helps form the community. It helps strengthen community bonds because...
You can do calendar events and
yeah, exactly. And you can talk about the businesses and the community events.
That sounds really expensive to run, though.
I was looking at the cost, and it is expensive. I mean, it's thousands of dollars to get a carrier that would, like, you know, blanket the central coast of California, for example, in this. It would be a lot of money. But I'm thinking that you could just run commercials, you know, get people, selling beds, like, you know.
But there's that new stuff coming out where you can, it's like TiVo for radio, where you can skip over commercials. I know
that's true.
And plus, listening to commercials, I hate listening to commercials. I always change the channel when I'm listening to commercials.
I know, especially, like, when you start hearing commercials, like on AM radio, for example, the bed commercials, just Cetopedic.
You hear them all the time.
I'm like, so I have beds. I don't want to hear those commercials anymore. That's true. That's really frustrating.
And some of the car commercials are really annoying. Yeah, so...
Okay, well, how about, I think it would be such a good thing for the community and for kind of bringing people together that you could theoretically just ask people to donate money that listen, and then they could just call you up and give money.
What, people would just... Nah. I think what you should do is go for grants. I bet you could get enough grants to run something like this.
I looked into it. You can get enough grants to run almost half of the cost, but really you need people that are listening to participate by giving money.
Do you think... No, people wouldn't just give money to listen to
people
the radio.
People totally would give money to listen to the radio.
No way.
Yeah.
Prove it.
All the time. Well,
prove
Ralph,
it.
Ralph's our guest today. Ralph, if you hear something you really like, let's say on this technology called FM radio, would you donate money?
Well, yeah, because it's cheaper than TiVo.
That's very true. Let's say you got a show that you like every day listen to Democracy Now!, which I hear you listen to. Is it important enough to spend your money, even though you could listen to it for free?
It's crucial. I mean, it's worth thousands and thousands of dollars, but not everybody can afford that much. So I sort of pay what I can afford. But if I had a lot more money, I think that I would write a bigger check.
Well, Ralph, I want to thank you for contributing earlier today to KUSP. KUSP has officially made its goal of $125,000. And Ralph and everyone out there listening who participated in giving money to KUSP, thank you for making this pledge drive a roaring success.
Yay! Thank
you're
you,
welcome.
Everybody. Without all of you, this would not work. Ralph pushed us over that last little bit.
All right. We've closed the drive, but that shouldn't stop you if you didn't get to do it, to go ahead and give us a call and pledge 476-5900, 1-800-655-5877, and of course, you can go to kusp.org. While you're opening up your browser, go ahead and take a look at geekspeak.org and take a click at Ralph Abraham's link. He's got a whole page about his career and life in mathematics and in the community. Ralph Abraham, professor of emeritus at University of California, expert on multi-genres of math. Chaos theory is a big belt loop on your on your list of things. Ralph, thank you very much for joining us today on GeekSpeak.
It's a pleasure. It's so long since I've been here that all the vinyls has been replaced with CDs.
Yes. The last time you were here, it was all vinyl?
Yeah. The walls were covered with
you
records.
You know, we still have. There's a back wall that has tons of vinyl in it. And when we redid the remodel of the station, we had to reinforce the building. We had to put steel struts under the building for that wall of vinyl. And in the air room here, we have CDs, which you can compress, you know, put you can put a lot more in there. But before, yeah, it used to be wall-to-wall with vinyl. And I know that the room was remodeled and kind of changed in shape. I think it was pushed out, that wall. But in general, it feels a lot bigger because you don't have, you know, 19 inches of music pushing in. You've only got six or whatever it is. So, yeah, it's been a while that you've been here since then.
Yeah,
last time you were here, my father was probably station manager.
That's right.
Yeah.
He was.
All right, let's get to math.
Okay.
I think everybody listening has gone through elementary school and high school or junior high or is currently doing so. Hopefully they should be in classes, though. Throughout that education, you get this basic elementary level math. And as you go up in high school, you get these different, you know, classes of math that are very separated. And they feel like their own islands of math. You've got algebra and geometry and trigonometry and calculus. And they all feel like these very specific slices. And if you talk to someone about trigonometry, they have the flashback of high school going, oh, so hard, I didn't understand it. And people stop in there somewhere. And only the people that really love it at that point keep on going and get to more exciting stuff that, for example, you are involved in. Can you talk about why, just briefly, why those schools are so separated?
It's a shame, isn't it? Because in other fields like science or music, dance, the arts, you can educate yourself, you can continue your passion for the field forever just by reading, browsing the web, and so on. In mathematics, you get to a stopping point. Most people do, and then that's it. So whatever is going on in mathematics remains forever a mystery.
Yeah.
What a drag.
It is a drag. It's kind of like the Earth pull on its own gravitational field.
It is a little different from other fields in that it is not really a verbal, spoken, written thing.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you can't pick up a book and read. It's got its own language, which is as difficult as Japanese.
Yeah.
But there's something wrong with, in my theory, with the educational program, with the curriculum in schools, so that it brings people unnecessarily to a dead end. In fact, it's worse than a stopping point. Because
it's a hatred.
People end up with a hatred, which we call math anxiety or the math avoidance reflex. That there is a strong negative instead of just a neutral or a stop or something. And that's a shame.
And I'm wondering if that's the way it's taught in these little isolates, if it's because of the way it's kind of migrated. I mean, I understand it's a very hard thing to do, to teach everybody in the population a new language. But do you think that's part of it, that there's these segregations between the different schools of math, if you will?
Well, math, like everything, has a history.
Mm-hmm.
And in history, there are these quantum leaps, really, where you get, you know, some new idea and a whole new branch begins. So there are islands, and they're all connected up in a sort of a global map. But I think that what happens in school is that things are taught in the wrong order, so that you got the branches in the wrong order. For example, historical order is...
Now, what's the historical order?
First of all, arithmetic, and then you have geometry, and then algebra, and then analysis, which includes calculus and so on. This is historical order.
Mm-hmm.
So
because people first thought about arithmetic, then later they realized that geometrical calculations could really do some neat things.
Yeah, it was a huge breakthrough. There's breakthroughs, like we know them. Like in the Renaissance, you had perspective.
Right.
So suddenly we broke out of two dimensions into three. It was
fabulous. And it totally affected a lot of things.
Everything.
Yeah.
And who did it? Artists. I mean, you didn't have to have a PhD in mathematics in
right.
order to participate
to
in
understand
the
it.
Creative
That's right.
frontier. So the reason historical order is important is that the concepts of one instant in the history of the subject are based on everything that existed preceding. So algebra comes out of geometry historically.
And therefore we teach it that way.
Studied geometry would sooner or later have an aha where they reinvented for themselves algebra. But do they teach it that way? No,
yeah.
They teach the algebra first and the geometry later. So
well, that's a little strange.
So you're being taught a concept that in algebra, in the high school curriculum, where you don't really have the prerequisites.
Uh-huh.
It's not possible to really understand. Therefore, you don't understand. And then you're blamed for not understanding, and then the hatred begins.
Of math in general.
I think another thing that happens is it's taught out of context. Like, you'll just be given algebra, and you're not told this is the basis of tools that you will later need.
Right.
Well, even if
you're told that, it's because of that abstraction, because you're not trying to solve your art project, for example.
They never give you a practical application.
Yeah.
At least not how I was taught. And it really made me think, this is useless. Why do I even want to bother with it?
Well, this violation of the historical order is one of the reasons that the context isn't included.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you teach not only the math, but everything in historical order, then in a certain historical epoch, you have the mathematics of that time with the physics of that time with the music of that time with the painting of that time, and it all links together in an obvious way.
I'm assuming
it did, because culture has integrity.
Right, right. Now, I'm assuming that there's some private schools that are teaching in this fashion. Do you know of any?
Well,
historical-based? I mean,
yeah, I had the opportunity to design a curriculum from scratch for a private school. It's called the Ross School.
The which?
Ross, R-O-S-S. So ross.org you can find on the World Wide Web. But what we tried to do there was, first of all, reorder not only math, but history and all the subjects in historical order. And secondly, to coordinate and link them up.
Mm-hmm.
So that teachers of different disciplines are working in teams where they figure out a lesson plan jointly, mm-hmm. and then deliver it jointly. So
that the student isn't jumping between period to period going, okay, this is a total... Drop
right.
everything I'm remembering from the last class.
Yeah.
Take a new... So they're connected.
It starts in the fifth grade at this particular school, and in the... So each grade is devoted to a certain epoch of history, and they mm-hmm. go in sequence.
And they follow what was learned at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the fifth grade, if you're in ancient Babylonia, then you have Babylonian arithmetic, Babylonian physics, Babylonian painting, myth, history, music, and so on.
Now, did
you're
Babylonian
living in Babylonia?
Did Babylonian math system is that a basis for some of the math
that came arithmetic.
Later? It's arithmetic.
Just the same as we have today.
Right.
Well, they didn't have geometry.
So it shouldn't be called arithmetic. It should be called Babylonian.
Babylonian math.
Right.
Yeah, or Egyptian.
Let me touch base. I think if everybody has an idea of what arithmetic is, but how would you briefly define what geometry is?
Geometry is about John was talking about space.
Mm-hmm.
Well, space is a new idea. You know, in the ancient world, we did not have any spatial context that we lived and moved in. And the spatial
idea... They only thought about things, if you will.
...developed very gradually, primarily from observation of the sky. And we didn't have TV in 5000 B.C. So what we used to do is get in our sleeping bags around the fire and tell stories.
Uh-huh.
And then eventually the fire would go out, but your sleeping bag is warm. And then you're staring at the sky until you go to sleep. So every night you have a sky lesson.
Yeah.
And you develop certain concepts, like these stars, see those three in a row, let's call that the belt. And against the, you know, constellations that leap out of you and stories develop, and then you could recognize them. And so the idea of a sphere, the celestial sphere, developed from the observation of this rotating, the dome of the sky.
And that's, to some degree, a big abstraction of what we touch normally. Like, normally things were described as if you touch things and you interact with them. But this is kind of a conceptual thing.
Yeah, you know, they didn't have wheels in those days until 3500 B.C. There were no wheels. But wheels first appeared in toys. Like, are games
oh, really?
Any good? Games are a waste of time. Let me tell you, they're a waste of time and money. So the wheel was developed in toys. This is an archaeological fact. And that later on, bigger wheels were made for carts. And then we get the urban revolution because the farmyard could be separated from the city.
That's still where we get a lot of our ideas, though. It's from our imagination, our exploration of our imagination.
Yeah, so here's my theory about the toy wheels, is that there was an attempt to make a model for the celestial sphere, where the wanderers, they occupy the edge of a wheel.
Okay.
You know, like this rubber tire and the zodiacal constellations you can mark on it. And then if you twist the toys of this that are essentially celestial models have been found in ancient Egypt.
And
they also gave rise to tops, which is such a thing that you spin and drop it. But there was a little wheel on an axle. So the axle goes from the north to the south celestial pole, and the rim of the wheel is the zodiacal belt. And from the observation of the sky came the construction of all of our concepts of space. Hence, geometry and so on began in ancient Egypt with these toys. And then became Greek geometry. And it was based on arithmetic because you had to measure the angles and the times.
To figure the toys out, but also to figure out the stuff that went past from the toys to actually start implementing in the fields, for example.
Yeah.
Very cool. So they really do, and that's a perfect example, if you will, of the connection of multiple different things. Toys from just going to sleep at night and viewing the sky to new math stuff, geometry starting to come in place. They really do connect. We got to do a quick break, but we're going to stay with Ralph Abraham. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. If you have questions, go ahead and send us an email message at geekspeak.org. We're not taking calls today because we were doing a pledge drive. Well, we were doing a pledge drive until our drive was met. And thank you all for meeting that pledge. If you feel like you want to be part of that, you're welcome to do so by giving us a ring at 47... Well, I guess it's still the same phone number. 476-5900 or 800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to kusp.org. This week on This American Life, when you talk about music, stories of people whose lives have been transformed by music, we'll hear about Tom Jones' impersonator, They Might Be Giants, and the wisdom gleaned from accordion teacher. That's This American Life, Saturday at 10 a.m., right after Car Talk on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. This program is supported by a grant from Cruzio, providing internet services, including DSL, spam filters, PHP, MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruzio membership is available online at cruzio.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geek this morning is John Tracy, and the math geek this morning is Ralph Abraham. And we're talking about math. Oh, and we have some thank yous. John, please. Want to give me half of those? Go ahead.
Sure. Actually, I'll give you...
All right, go ahead.
I'll give you two. I'll take it. I'd like to start off by thanking Fred and Roberta from Boulder Creek. They listen to Geek Speak and Democracy Now. Thank you very much for your pledge.
I'd like to thank Kimberly from Pacific Grove. Thank you very much for your pledge.
I'd like to thank Sally from Capitola, who also listens to Demo, and Travis Smiley, and Deb from Carmel, who appreciates the attention to quality programming. Thank you both very much.
And I have one more thank you, and I already have, but I'll do it again. Ralph Abraham, thank you very much for pledging your support to KUSP. Ralph's from Santa Cruz and likes Democracy Now! And is on currently Geek Speak, which you're listening to. Ralph, so this base level math is taught in your assessment in an order in which it doesn't make enough sense for the human psyche, and people get turned off by it, and they stop at some point.
Yeah, there are two problems with using the ahistorical order. And one is the concepts are impossible to learn, so you have to stop, and you have to hate. And the other is, as John was saying, that you're missing the historical connections and the way in which everything is connected up, and therefore the relevance of math, and why you might want it, need it, and be able to use it.
Okay. Let's talk about the first thing you just said, that it's so... You can't comprehend it. You have to stop. What do you mean? Where is that point where it's not something you can understand? Because it's different for everybody, of course.
Surprisingly, it's almost the same for everybody.
Really?
That's what gives the clue
that it's being done wrong.
My theory. Yeah, I think it was in the eighth grade, my son John came home, and he was just furious. He said, well, the teacher said, let X be a number. Well, what number is it? Uh-huh. So now in computer language, you have a variable. X is a variable.
Right.
And that's a place on your hard drive, basically, where you're going to put something. And
right.
You put something there, that's the number. And if you want to refer to it later, you know the address, you can go get it.
But it's a real thing on a computer.
Not a number.
Right.
It's a place to put a number.
Okay.
So the concept of algebra was introduced before there was any geometry.
For these students.
Historically, mm-hmm. for everybody in the American educational system. I think you get geometry after algebra.
Okay, so algebra you think is a primary problem where
algebra
you don't understand why
problem.
You're trying to
you
take away the numbers.
For,
it's like it's math, but I'm not using numbers, so why is it math?
Yeah.
It is a complicated
what's
thing.
What's this x squared minus 2x equals 5? What's, you know, who cares?
And then it's this rule that you're learning. You're learning these rules that you have to follow,
yeah.
but not getting reasoning or rationale. And
yeah,
it gets
originally that. X squared minus 5x equals 2 or something was a shortcut for a geometrical construction where you're trying to figure out how long the fence should be
right.
in order to enclose a given area, which is the amount of area
which is what you need to know
on, which
right.
you need to know
right for tank taxes and of course for holding your stock and the whole
yeah.
deal right so because of that lack of context. Okay, well let's skip ahead a few steps. Let's like go into calculus because I got through. Let's say in my education, I went ahead and went into like pre-calculus in high school, and then started taking calculus in college, and probably didn't complete calculus not because it was too difficult at that point, but more that there was other things in my life going on. Do you think calculus is one of those things? Another breaking point where it becomes really difficult to comprehend what's going on?
Yeah. but for a different reason, I think that, this is appropriate because this is geek speak. So now I'm going to talk about geek math. And that is the calculus that you learn and which is still taught in university, where you have these tables of integrals and there are these very arcane formulas. And you can't memorize them, but you have the encyclopedia in which you look to find the answer to a certain, you know, integral or derivative problem. So those strategies were all introduced because there was no effective way to compute them. So let's say a certain function, if you visualize as a graph,
mm-hmm.
then the integral of that function will be the area under the graph.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see this as a generalization of the algebra problem where you're trying to figure out how long the fence should be
right.
to enclose a given area. It's an area problem. You could draw the graph on graph paper and count the squares under the graph and get an approximation. It's a numerical problem, a given graph, the given area under it. So before computers came along, the only way to solve this problem was this very difficult arcane thing that's miraculous that it exists at all.
So how do computers help? What do computers do?
Well, they give you the number.
Oh, I see.
You put in the function and push the button,
do you
and
think
then it
this
tells you the area under the graph or the integral.
Do you think this amazing system of calculus, which we're learning before you go further, do you need to know that to keep going? To understand chaos theory?
Well,
or
No. Well, not the calculus they teach. You take the calculus course, it lasts an entire year.
Right.
You're going like 5 days a week for an hour and 10 minutes for a year.
I think someone here has taught calculus before.
Well, yeah, and I've taught that the second year of it, uh-huh. where the people who were the best in the class in the first course
managed
still
to survive.
Can't remember a thing about it.
Oh, yeah.
They did very well. They can't remember a thing about it. So you can't assume they know the so-called prerequisite for
right.
the second course because you can't be remembered.
So now you're reteaching.
Because the basic concepts weren't included in the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
how you could take this course that lasts for a year daily and end up not knowing what is the basic idea. So what
something's
you need
wrong.
To know to go on to chaos, there's only the basic idea, which you could get somehow, but not from the course. What you do get from the course, how to look in the book and find the answer to a very, very special case, you soon forget, as you should. So the curriculum does somehow work for certain people. For me, it worked to become an engineer, to be able to use the calculus to solve problems like how large and dense an O-ring to use to as
right.
a gasket and a certain pump, which right. I used to do as an engineer. I used calculus to solve those problems. So uh-huh. it does, like, sort of work. I took these courses before computers. Right. Computers didn't exist. And now I think what should be taught in school in place of calculus is how to use the...
software.
The hand calculator.
to how to really be effective with these tools that are so
understand
great.
Understand the concept.
Yeah.
Know how to use the tool and understand what it's good for and historically what the function is.
A lot of people think that calculators and computers are kind of a crutch when you're doing math, but you know that you don't have to know as much math to use them. But actually, you still have to know math very well to know how to input the information into the computer
yeah.
in order to get the answer.
Well, yeah, you need some real old-fashioned, heavily trained symbolic mathematicians around every once in a while to check that the computer is actually doing what
of
it
course,
it's doing.
Of course, of course. And assume but, we can assume that we'll probably have people of your caliber doing that kind of thing for our computers.
There will always be a few around. But speaking of crutches, okay, let's talk about slide rules. When I was in engineering school, I had a slide rule a foot long that dangled in a leather case from my belt.
Uh-huh.
And the slide rule is based on logarithms. And logarithms were introduced in the 18th century. Before that, people didn't have them. Toward the end of his life, Kepler found out about logarithms. And he had done all these computations. It would be a stack of papers, like I'm talking about 500 pages of arithmetic to solve one problem.
Right.
That with a slide rule, you do it in a minute.
Right.
So what did Kepler say? When logarithms came along.
Slide rules.
Like, I wish I had had this, you know, years ago, because he devoted his life
right.
to what could have been done in a month with
so,
a slide rule.
So now, so you're saying that the calculator, the crutch, if you will, that was taking away some of that 500-page stack of stuff to do was a slide rule before it was a calculator, and it's always been around. Any trick that can help you understand the next step of math is a good thing to use. So you're saying, go ahead and throw a computer in front of these students at the early age, you know, one of these little calculators that acts, I mean, is a computer, that helps them on their calculus so that they understand the concepts and they really get it rather than having to do it through rote. We got a call from, I hope that was right.
Yeah.
That? Okay.
Yeah. we got a call I from, agree. Good.
Good.
Good shot.
Aptos, from Aptos, Debbie, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. My question is from Mr. Abraham. I have a seventh grader who's taking high school algebra. He has an aptitude for math and has been grumbling a lot lately that all math is add, subtract, multiply, and divide. It's all he's done since first grade. When is there going to be something new? Positive and negative numbers, fractions, decimals, it's like changing the color of the marbles, but the game doesn't change. And he's bored and he wants something new and there isn't anything that is being offered. Is this a matter of the teaching, the way the applications are working, the tools that they're using? What do I tell him, and when does he get to do something new?
Well, it's time for geometry for him and for a lot of people in seventh grade. There should be Euclidean geometry. You know, every great mathematician of note is trained in math from the same textbook written in 300 B.C., Euclid's Elements, it's called. And
I guess it works.
Euclid's Elements can be overdone. The problem for you and your child is that it's difficult to do it alone. You can't learn math from a book. You need a teacher. If it's not going to be in school, then you have to regard it as something like chess or ballet that you want to learn, and it's not taught in the school. So what are you going to do? You have to find another teacher. Or some schools actually are teaching early geometry, and there may be one in Aptos, for all I know.
They have said next year that will be offered.
He's in seventh grade, you said?
Yes.
And it's a middle school that goes up to eighth grade, I'm assuming?
Right.
So it is being offered for the eighth graders right now,
it is
right?
They have a program to take the eighth graders to the high school and do geometry there.
Yeah.
But they won't take a seventh
grade. But again, does that get him out of, you'll be dealing with angles, but the things that you do once you've learned the lines, the angles, that is, to him, it all comes down to add, subtract, multiply, and divide.
Hmm. Ralph,
no, they're concepts. You see, Euclidean geometry is done without any absolute... There are no... The angles are only... It can be measured by matching two triangles up to compare them. There is no protractor. There's no measurement. There are straight edges, but not rulers. The constructions have to be done with a straight edge and compass.
And that that basis of understanding that the relationship between shapes is a really fundamental thing to understand.
And is fundamental to understand algebra. So I think it would be good.
But he's currently in algebra.
Get him out of the algebra. And
so Ralph,
send him off
can
to
you
high school to study the geometry.
Ralph, can you tutor Debbie's son? Is that something you do?
No, but there are a lot of tutors around who know how to do it.
And how to make it interesting.
But there's nobody around who's going to, like, organize the curriculum.
Well, except Debbie might be doing that. So how does Debbie go ahead and find a tutor? Like, I mean, finding a violin tutor, you go down to Union Grove and you find, you know, I mean, there's places to do this, to find people that do music and a lot of different arts.
Well,
how do you do that in math?
Math department at UCSC, for example, has a list of tutors who are former good students who are still around town and so on.
And what's the math department URL at UCSC? Do you know? Just go to ucsc.edu. And
it might be math.ucsc.edu.
That'd be kind of cool. Debbie, good luck. I hope that you go and find an instructor that allows your son to...
And get together with other parents who have the same problem, because homeschooling is really dealing with this.
Yeah, that's true. So another source would be a homeschool station, if you will.
Yeah.
Thank you, Debbie, for the call.
Thank you very much.
From Debbie's call, I have gleaned that we are now taking calls, thanks to our wonderful producer, Maggie Cleveland, who is finishing up the Pledge Drive stuff. She's been here all week, every morning, running shows, a dedicated person. Thank you, Maggie, very much for producing KOSP, for producing GeekSpeak and for helping with the Pledge Drive all week. Well, she's thrown your phone calls my way, so if you'd like to ask Ralph Abraham a question about mathematics, you're welcome to do about life in general. If you know some other passions of Ralph's, I'm sure he'll talk about them. The phone numbers are the same phone number, 476-5900, which is the Pledge Drive number, but call there. That's a good one. 476-5900 to ask Ralph Abraham a question, or 800-655-5877. And, of course, we will take your email calls or email questions. Go to geekspeak.org, click on Contact Us.
And we have some thank yous from the Pledge Drive, which, if you were listening earlier and you're not hearing any us do pledge driving, it's because we have met our goal. Thank you very much to all the listeners out there who've supported KOSP this year and in past years. We have Edward from SoCal. He really appreciate any and all that we're doing. Thank you very much. We have Tom from Santa Cruz, who... He usually supports jazz programming and supports Democracy Now!, the show right before us. We have Karen and Felton, who loves Reflections, Open Road, and Amy Goodman. Thank you very much for your support, Karen. We have Rona and Ivan from Santa Cruz. They love Democracy Now!, Open Road, and Terry Gross, a big-time listener of Democracy Now!. They really like it. And we have Todd from Seaside, Democracy Now!. You'd never guess what show comes right before
GeekSpeak.
Also, Christopher Palermo's. Oh yeah, Christopher Palermo's show. Good stuff here on KOSP. We have people supporting the entire station. It's always good to hear. Thank you very much for your support.
All right, we got a question through Insta Messenger from our normal geek Miles Elam, who is sick at home. How does the teaching it math and the entire school curriculum in historical context? And how math would work that way in learning math. How does that differ from the new math of the 1970s? Is it really different?
Well, it's the polar opposite.
Okay.
Matter of fact. the new math, which came from France, where it was a huge failure, was an attempt to put the newest math first in the curriculum.
Uh-huh. So you jump right into
this is the extreme example, which teaches what the fallacy is. Mm-hmm. You see, the reason that mathematics is taught more wrongly than any other subject is math has its implicit logical structure, where from the logical point of view, certain ideas come first.
When you're solving a problem, if you will. Okay.
Yeah, or when you're setting up a whole field, like calculus, geometry, especially geometry, you have the common notions, and then you have the postulates, and then you have the theorems and the lemmas and the propositions and so on. If you teach math in its logical order, then it's in the opposite of its historical order, because the logical formulation of mathematics only started about a century ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's excellent for a mature person who's already satisfied about the historical relevance of mathematics and understand the concepts basically to study the subject. This is what graduate students in mathematics do. You start all over again with the logical order.
Mm-hmm.
So the new math was an attempt to put the graduate program of mathematics into the elementary schools in France.
And that was a failure.
With set theory and Venn diagrams and so on. It was a huge failure.
So good thing that we're not doing it that way. And you're not suggesting in any way that we would reverse it completely.
I'm suggesting the historical order and integrated with other subjects, also taught in historical order. It comes out to something which is supremely interesting, and it obviates the whole problem of math anxiety and the mm-hmm. math avoidance reflex.
Before the show started, before you showed up this morning, John and I and the geeks, when the other geeks are not sick and they're here, we get together before the show and we talk a little bit about what the show's going to happen and stuff. And so I told John, I was like, yeah. So he said, we're going to have a math person on today. Who is it? And I said, oh, it's Ralph Abraham. And for me, just saying your name, because I've known you all my life, I know what you're, you know, a lot of the things you're interested in, what you do, and I knew that talking to you would be cool. I didn't know we were going to talk about so much about education, but I've been finding it fascinating. So I told him, well, he's got, you know, I tried to sum you up in some way, and it didn't really work. But one of the things that we started talking about right away was like chaos theory and fractals and these things that we know are high-level math that we don't necessarily understand, but we get some kind of general concept, and we know it's really interesting because we're both geeks. So can you make... Can you give us a little bit of rundown? Is there a connection at all between fractals and chaos theory?
Oh, yeah.
How?
Well, chaos and fractals are separate branches of mathematics which mm-hmm. have a small overlap, which is very
chaotic fractals?
Important.
Okay.
Chaotic fractals, uh-huh. yes. And those are the kind of regular fractals that you see on record covers and so on.
That's fractals
with
chaos?
Chaotic
okay.
definitions.
The pretty ones.
But the main thing I want to say is that chaos theory and fractal geometry are among the branches of geek mathematics, which is mathematics since the computer revolution.
Ah, okay.
So
and you think that's a big separation between math pre-computer and post-computer?
Well, you're huge. Yeah. So just as logarithms revolutionized practical mathematics in the distant past, the computer has not only further revolutionized all those existing branches of mathematics, but is also the platform for completely new branches of mathematics that maybe could be envisioned by a stoned mathematician in the past.
Really? Okay.
But in terms of any practical development that had to await the arrival of computers, so the computer is here. How did it get here? By the way, it was introduced first as a math tool, as a bomb site, for example. Analog mm-hmm. computer history begins with math machines for military use.
Right. Like DarkNet, the internet, I mean.
Yeah. Then you get the platform completely new branches of mathematics. They are among them chaos theory, fractal geometry, fuzzy logic, and so on. So not only... these are new branches of mathematics, but they stem from this platform, which is itself evolving at a fantastic rate, and as a matter of fact, may be co-evolving with the new branches of mathematics.
Right. It's almost as if your slide rule all of a sudden every day could do new things, and you're like, whoa. And it keeps on improving. Your tool set keeps on improving right beneath you, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about art playing a role to some degree in the exploration of math? Or vice versa. Any thoughts on that?
Well, a lot of mathematics in the past was developed by artists.
Like you talked about perception, perspective earlier.
Perspective is an example. I've got a book about this with, I think there are 6 or 8 chapters. Perspective is not even one of them.
Wow.
And they're all examples. It's called Bolts from the Blue. And the idea is that a new mathematical idea has occurred to somebody, probably not a mathematician, in a bolt of inspiration
uh-huh.
and then gets developed in such a way that it changes the whole of society so that you get a quantum leap in everything at once, like the Renaissance. You had perspective as an example.
And hence one of your foundation thoughts, that the thought process that was going on at the time and what was happening at the time of a certain type of math would help you understand the math.
Yeah.
Because
like
everything goes around
the
it.
The wheel is an example, because the circle is an abstract mathematical idea from the branch of math called geometry.
Mm-hmm.
That's all about circles and lines. So the circle came into some Stone Age person's head from
and made a toy.
Staring at the stars and made a toy, and then you got a wheel, and then you've got the urban revolution, and you've got, I mean...
Right. Boom, boom, boom.
Is that still happening these days, or have we stagnated? Because it seems
No, it's happening, but it's happening in the realm of software. For example, object-oriented programming is, I think, something like the wheel. It's gigantic. Of course, not everybody knows anything about it or ever heard of it. And people who know what it is and are totally at home with it don't even realize that it's like the wheel.
Same with the Internet, I think.
The Internet is the biggest thing since the wheel.
Speaking of...
Well, the World Wide Web in particular,
yeah,
I think.
Definitely. Let's go ahead and jump to a call from Santa Cruz. John, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask, Ralph, I love the idea of your curriculum following a progression of history, but how do you avoid the problem of teaching mistaken or faulty models from previous eras, like pre-continental drift theory or alchemy rather than chemistry?
Well, I think that's a really excellent question. And part of my problem with the current curriculum is that alchemy is not taught. I think that chemistry is more understandable if you follow the sequence. And alchemy is pre-chemistry or proto-chemistry. It's not a pseudoscience. It is historical science.
Right. And we've got to say really clearly that I mean, my feeling very strongly on alchemy, for example, is a perfect example of this, that normally when you learn stuff, you learn all these correct things. And then when you have a thought that might not be correct and is wrong, you think you're a failure in that thought process. But in reality, the way that we got to these correct assumptions was making a lot of mistakes, or a lot of exploration, if you will. And so alchemy is a major branch of exploration. It went somewhere. It went a lot of places. It went to where we are now.
Yeah, in fact, chemistry
is
like alchemy from the perspective of the future. See, chemistry will be all wrong. So to have the historical sequence available to us relativizes our current knowledge, so we don't idealize it as the absolute truth, which is perhaps
so you
not.
You can rethink it. If you know that for 2,000 years people thought...
Along,
yeah.
And some people committed suicide. So
that's
if you're a chemist and you know about alchemy, you're in a better position to survive the next quantum leap in understanding.
Indeed, but, I mean, are you still not going to teach chemistry to a fifth grader at the basic level? Modern chemistry?
Well, I don't know if modern chemistry is taught in the fifth grade.
No.
I really don't think so. At least when I was in school.
Some of the basics are.
The thing is, a lot of the basics of alchemy. I mean, starting chemistry by understanding the periodic table of it's such an abstraction right away. It's like, well, what are these things? What are those little things? Well, we're not going to tell you what those little things are for a long time, and when we do tell you later, we'll tell you that it's different. So it's like learning the periodic table is not the first step in chemistry, or not necessarily.
No, it's dissolving salt in water, and then the water evaporates, and the salt precipitates. Well, that's exactly what alchemists were doing.
Right, processes.
Yeah, and alchemy had an important role in early medicine with Paracelsus, who was one of the first experimental scientists. Now, I think that attaining concepts, building on them, and then the old ones are sort of absorbed into the new ones is, you know, that's the learning process. The epitome of the learning process is
so you
the
have
same
the Greeks,
the
though. They have atomic theory back, you know, B.C., but then you have alchemy Middle Ages.
The Greeks had a so-called atomic theory, but it's nothing like what we call atomic theory, because it was just that, matter is made of particles, as it were.
Which, if you can think about it, that was chemistry. I mean, that idea of atomic theory was a chemical level atomic theory.
Okay.
But I think it's a valid point. There definitely is these steps in... that were branches that were, quote, wrong. But then again, the exploration of those obviously motivated a lot of people. If you tell a group of fifth graders that today we're going to make gold, and you give them all these tools, and you talk about how for hundreds of years people tried to do this, and you go through it, and you go all these different ways, and you come to this conclusion that, you can't make gold, even if it's 2 weeks of doing this, that's a major learning experience. You understand the difference between atomic quantum theory and atomic particles, quarks and such, and chemistry. And that's a big thing to understand. A lot of people don't get that separation, if you will, or that perceived separation. Thank you, John, for the call.
Thank you.
We got some more thank yous to do.
I'd like to thank Vinny from Santa Cruz, who pledged via the web. I'd like to thank Henrietta from, I'm not sure where she's from, Aaron's. That doesn't sound like a place.
But go, keep going.
Who supports Democracy Now!, Dr. Don, and Us Geeks. We have Nanette from Santa Cruz, who enjoys all of KOSP. Shelley from Carmel, supporting Amy Goodman and classical music. And we have Elizabeth from Santa Cruz, who is supporting Democracy Now! As well. So thank you very much for your support of KOSP.
Thank you all. I'd like to invite Kip from Aptos, who's currently on the phone, to go ahead and send us an email. We'll try to answer it through email. You can go to geekspeak.org to answer your Mac question. John, I'm sure, will respond. Because we're very quickly running out of time here on Geekspeak, Ralph, I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I wish I...
You too.
I want to do it again, actually, and keep going. But thank you very much for coming on Geekspeak. I appreciate it.
A pleasure.
Grey Wolf Computer Systems has provided a grant in support of this program. Grey Wolf Computer Systems offers custom computer systems and personalized service for repairs, upgrades, and networks in the East Cliff Village Shopping Center in Santa Cruz. Our producer, as I mentioned a little earlier, is Maggie Cleland, tirelessly devoted to KUSP and to GeekSpeak, thank goodness for us. She does a lot of work here, and I really appreciate her for supporting the station, which I grew up with, and for supporting GeekSpeak, which I've been doing for about 3.5 years or so. Also, in the Arum, of course, Ralph Abraham, professor of emeritus, but still, you know, teaching everybody that he talks to, I think, for coming on and talking about math. And, of course, John Tracy, owner of FeltonGames.com, thank you very much for being here to talk shop and answer some news.
It's always a pleasure.
Next week, we're talking about electronics voting systems. We'll be here next week at 10 a.m. This is Central Coast Public Radio, Santa Cruz, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Diego, or on the web at kusp.org. Stay tuned now for NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The presidential race is coming down to the wire, with the candidates hitting key battleground states less than 2 weeks before the election. Democratic candidate John Kerry was in Wisconsin. He told a rally that America's